Scott's dead big book study, where we will study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's date is Saturday, the 27th of January, 2024. My name is Maria F., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm from County Dublin in Ireland, and I'll be your host for today's study. Our co-host today is Dottie S., and our question and answers is Veronica. If you have any questions or any concerns during the meeting, you can contact either myself, Dottie, or Veronica, and you can do this by private message in the chat function. Please note that our speaker today, Harlan G, will be recorded for the duration of the study. However, the question and answer section which follows, we don't record that. So do feel free to ask Harlan any questions that you might have for him during that time. We kindly ask that you keep your microphones on mute at all times during today's study. If you need to step away from your camera at any time, just disconnect your camera for the time that you're doing that. Otherwise, we'd really love you to keep your camera on, just so that we can be here together. We've posted a link in the chat of the previous week's recordings and also of the self-edition payment, so you can use that if you need to make a payment or to look up any of the previous weeks that we've recorded. So we're now going to go to Scottsdale in Arizona and say good morning to Harlan G. Good morning, Harlan.
Oh, good morning, Maria. Thank you so much. And as I often say, my sincere hope is that wherever you are, if you're listening on a podcast or you're listening live, that it is as astounding where you are as it is here. The high here today is supposed to be 73. There isn't a cloud in the sky. It is absolutely ideal for anything that you want to do. It is already in the mid 60s, and it is just astounding here today. We have been talking about the doctor's opinion, and I think it's kind of strange that we're almost right on the same paragraph, it we're in the same chapter as they are on vision right now, but they move quicker than we do because they can do at least five paragraphs a week where we can't. I just can't go that fast in most cases because the purpose of this is to give you more of an in-depth sort of look into some of the things. And I give you a little history when I can, when it's appropriate for what we are reading. We're talking about the doctor's opinion. And in the doctor's opinion, which many, many times I have stated both here in meetings, on vision, no matter where I am speaking, I will tell you this. Without Dr. Silkworth and his opinion, there is no program. There is no book. There is no program. Because if we are just going to rely on what the text of the book is from page one to page 164, we don't really see the problem. The only one that really had the description of the problem was Dr. Silkworth. And as much as anybody, I believe that there were more than two founders to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're going to limit it to Bob and Bill, you're really blind to a lot of what went on. As much as anybody, Dr. Silkworth is critical to recovery. He describes the problem for us in such a way that we can build on it. Because without this description of the problem, it's very, very difficult to understand even the need for the solution because you don't know what the problem is. It just doesn't make any sense. And today we're going to start on page XXIX. I'm not going to get there yet, as is my history with you, my want. I'm telling you where we're going to start. It's page XXIX. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. But before we do, let's kind of review what it is we have established thus far. What we have established thus far is that we who are compulsive overeaters suffer from a twofold disease. Two. The first being the mental twist. Now, mental obsession is 12 and 12 language. I stick to big book language. Not that mental obsession is incorrect. It's very correct. It's very descriptive. It's very correct. I like to stick to big book language because that's just who I am. Mental twist is the language of the big book. And what Dr. Silkworth establishes with us is the reason why we eat the way we eat. And what does he say on the previous page? He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So when we get this effect, what is the effect? The effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating certain foods, certain foods. Today is Saturday. Thursday, I had an opportunity to go out to lunch with two friends that I have known for 60 years. I've known these men for 60 years. I know everything about them. I've been to their homes. There's nothing about that. I knew their parents, their grandparents, some of their aunts and uncles, and I know their siblings, and I know everything about them. They knew my parents, whatever it is. When they eat, they do not get what I get from the food. The food doesn't do for me what it does for them. Now, all food? No, not all food. But when I eat anything French fried, you French fry a shoe, I'll eat it. But I'm talking Chips Ahoy. I'm talking donuts. I'm talking pizza. I'm talking whatever it is, M&Ms with peanuts, of course, not the other kind. But you give me those foods, and those foods will do something for me, that they don't do for my friends. What is it that they do? They give me an effect. What is the effect? The effect is a sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating those foods. In other words, when I'm not eating them, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. It says that in the book. Throw in scared to death, angry as hell, jealous, insecure, guilt-ridden, shame-ridden, inadequate in my own eyes. And so for me, when I am eating Doritos, I feel like I think you feel all the time. Whether you feel that way or not is not material. I have looked at the world through a fence my whole life, and I saw people, and they passed me by on the street, or I saw them in the grocery store, or I saw them in my school, or I saw whatever, it doesn't matter where I saw them. And even though they were probably going through their own hell at the time, in my eyes, I saw them as whole. I saw them as together. I saw them as brave. I saw that they had the instruction manual for life. And I was denied this instruction manual. And I felt like I had to do twice as much to be half as good. And I didn't feel like I could match up to these people. I just didn't feel like I could. They had something on me. They had something on me that I just couldn't put my finger on. But I became very, very frustrated by life. And no matter what happened in my life, I never felt like I was one of them. I always felt apart from rather than a part of. And then I took an Almond Joy bar in my mouth. And for 9 seconds, my brain felt fantastic. Fantastic. I felt like I could conquer the world. I felt like I could dream. Because when I wasn't eating, I didn't dare dream. Because I knew, I didn't think, I knew that any dream that I would dream would turn to crap. Because I knew that my weight and the food would pull the rug out from under me and my dreams would go up in smoke. But when I was eating, I just felt great. The only problem is it only lasts about 9 seconds. 10 seconds would be too much. 9 seconds. Now, let's just say that was the only thing that was the problem was the mental twist. I would carry around a Batman utility belt, and inside I would put M&Ms with peanuts, not plain. Obviously, the people that buy plain M&Ms, obviously these are not Jewish people. Anybody that would buy a plain M&M is missing the boat, because why would I pay the same dime or nickel for plain M&Ms when I can get chocolate covered peanuts? Doesn't make any sense. Obviously, these are not Jewish people buying these other ones. No way. So I would take M&Ms with peanuts and I would load them into a utility belt like Batman had. And every time I felt scared, which was all the time, if I was honest with you, when I wasn't eating and you asked me how I was doing, I would say to you, I'm scared to death. And if you said to me, what are you scared of? I didn't have an answer for you. I didn't know, but I lived with this dread. I lived with this sword of Damocles. I lived with this feeling of dread every minute of every day. I didn't know how to live in the world. I didn't know how to function in the world. I never knew that what was enough or what did I have to do. So I did nothing. I did nothing. I was not a good student because I didn't do the work. You know, our friend in New Jersey, Kim G, she says, I'm very sorry you got no results from the work you didn't do. Well, in school, I didn't get any good grades from the work I didn't do. So the bottom line is, I would pop an M&M in my mouth, and the world would just be a beautiful place. I describe it like this. You've heard me do this before. In The Wizard of Oz, which the monkeys scared the crap out of me, those monkeys kept me up for like weeks. But in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy goes from this like sepia gray, this very gray world. When the tornado hits, everything is in shades of gray and that. And then all of a sudden she lands in Oz and the world just goes right to Technicolor, the most brilliant, the most beautiful Technicolor you ever saw in your entire life. And no better description of what happened to me when I would eat certain foods than that. That is the perfect description of what happens in my brain when I'm eating candy, M&Ms, or fried anything. Fry a tire, I'll eat it. Fry a brick, I'll eat it. Because if it's French fried, that's going to do it for me. But the bottom line is, if all I had was that mental part of it, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, right? You just take your M&M and you're good. There's one other part of this disease that Dr. Silkworth describes eloquently and perfectly, and that is the physical allergy. When I first came into OA, it was February 2nd, which will be next week, February 2nd, 1979. It was a freezing cold Friday night. There was an ice storm. It was just a miserable, miserable day. It was a Friday, as I recall. I'll have to look that up, but I believe I'm right. It was a Friday in 1979, February 2nd. And I went to this meeting, and somebody who's still around, she still comes here once in a while, and she said to me, "You can't eat these foods," because I had a, all the things I just told you. She says, "You're allergic to them." And I'd say, "That's not true. That can't be right. I can't be allergic to these things because I don't break out in a rash. I don't start sneezing. I don't start doing all those things. My eyes don't run." And she'd say, "Just don't eat them. You're allergic." And I went home. And there was a source of information that many of you do not remember. You're too young. It was called a dictionary. If you don't know what a dictionary is, you can Google it. It was called a dictionary. I don't think they even have them anymore. I think everybody looks it up on their phone. But anyway, I looked up this word allergy, and there were several definitions of allergy, like there are a lot of words have many definitions. And I looked it up, and there was a description or a definition of allergy. It said adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. Adverse means it's harmful. Adverse means harmful. Abnormal means most people do not react the way I react to those foods. So if my reaction to these foods is both adverse and abnormal, I am considered to be allergic to those foods. So does the definition fit me exactly? You bet it does. It fits me perfectly. And so when I eat these foods, it tripwires a craving. That craving, that physical craving, sets me apart from the normal. And Dr. Silkworth explains that any description of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. So Dr. Silkworth informs me through this opinion of his that he wrote that my disease has two characteristics, a mental twist and a physical allergy, a craving. And it is this craving that sets me apart from normal people. That's very, very important for me to understand. I can't eat these foods because they will make me eat more of them than I would like to eat. And that's when I gain all this weight. And that's when the fat on my body begins to kill me. And I can't keep from eating these foods because I crave this effect. I desire this effect more than I desire anything in life. If I can't eat because of the allergy, and I have to eat because of the twist of the mind, I am, by definition, a compulsive overeater. That's what a compulsive overeater is. It is a person that has a physical allergy and a twist of the mind. One without the other would mean that I'm not a compulsive overeater. And there are factions of OA, and there are people who, whether they know it or not, whatever, I don't know. They will fight me on this or fight the book on this, not me. They'll fight the book and say, I don't have the mental part. I don't have the physical part, whatever that might be. By definition, you are not a compulsive overeater if that is the case. A compulsive overeater has two characteristics. Number one, the mental twist. In search of that effect to bathe the brain in good feelings. Number two, the physical allergy, which sets up the craving for more of the same. Those are the two characteristics of a compulsive overeater. Okay, with that in mind, we're talking about the doctor's opinion. We're on page XXIX. That's XXIX. And we're in the middle of the page. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change, spiritual awakening. Though the aggregate just means total, of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable. We physicians must admit we have made little impressions upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So let's take a look at what the doctor is telling us for the second time in this 8-page chapter. This is the second time that he is telling you he knows what's wrong with you and there is nothing he can do for you. There's nothing he can do for you. The doctor is inadequate in the force of this disease. My father had cancer, and in 1978, he passed away. And I went to the oncologist and I said to him, what are we going to do? I don't have, my mom died in 76. This was 78. What are we going to do? Blah, blah, blah. Oh my God, I'm only 24 years old, 23 at the time. He says, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. And my father died not long after that. There are times when doctors are inadequate. But what's more important that we remember about that we remember this, that nothing that is of this earth, nothing is going to help you. You get it in your mind at times that if you had this, if you could go there, if you had this, if this person would only, when this person does, that somehow that is going to line up for you as a solution to the ennui, the discomfort, the anger, the happiness, the fear, the boredom, the frustration, the guilt, the shame, the remorse, the conditions of earth are not going to jar your disease. You didn't cause it. You can't cure it. You can't control it, nor can anything of this earth. Now, we're going to talk more about this when we get to page 60, which won't be for a while. It'll probably be months from now. We're going to talk about the ABCs. But we're going to talk about them today. A, that you are alcoholic and could not manage your own life. B, that no human power could have relieved your alcoholism. That's the one we're going to talk about today. That C, no human power could have relieved your alcoholism. But we're also going to talk that God could and would if he were sought. No one of this earth caused your disease. There are identical twins. They shared an egg. They shared a womb. They shared a whatever. Whatever it was, they grew up in the same house. They had the same mother, the same father. They had the same teachers. They had the same sisters, brothers. They had the same earthly situations. Nothing was different. They're twins. Often shared a bedroom. And yet one weighs 340. And one weighs 170. One is a drug addict, one is not. One is a gambler, one is not. One is an alcoholic, one is not. There is no earthly explanation. No earthly condition caused your disease. No earthly situation is going to relieve it. Your defense must come from a higher power. At no time in your life was there anything other than momentary relief from anything earthly. Now, we could all tell our tale of woe. We could all tell our tale of woe. And we could make people feel horrible. You're so unfortunate. I have driven off the showroom floor with a car that had 4 miles on it, 8 miles on it. I have walked into my house and it was mine. A dream I have dreamed since I was a little boy, owning my own house. I own this house. I mean, I pay a mortgage, but this is my house. I own it. Now, it's not fancy. It's nothing I'm, I wouldn't pull up here and think you're gonna faint from envy or so. No, I have a very modest townhouse, very, very modest, but it's extremely affordable and it allows me the freedom to spend money on other things, which is exactly what I wanted. I don't want to be house poor. I want to own, but I want to be able to travel. I want to be able to do what I want and go where I want. And, I'm going to go to PETA Jungle after this, and I'm going to probably pick up the check this week and so on and so forth. I think it's my week to pay. But anyway, where was I going to? Oh, money won't fix your problem. There were times when temporarily I got the house, I got the car, I got the wife, I got the kid. We got the company up to that certain level that we had only dreamed possible. It never fixed me. It doesn't fix this problem. It may give you a band-aid. It may put a band-aid on a gunshot wound so that very temporarily you can feel like everything's going to be okay. Now, how many times did I drive the car off the showroom floor and vow, I'm never going to eat in this car. I'm never going to fart in this car. I'm never going to pick my nose in this car. And there I was 3 days later, passing gas and throwing Kentucky Fried Chicken bones out the window. How long did it take before the car became the car? The house became the house. The kid became the kid. Not long. Nothing stays new and exciting for very long. And even if it did, not going to help you. Doesn't help me, won't help you. So that Dr. Silkworth is telling us unequivocally that he can't help you, expand that into the macro and understand that nothing of this earth is going to help you with this. I'm going to mention some names, and if you're too young to know who they are, you can write them down and Google them. James Gandolfini, Mama Cass Elliot, Chris Farley, John Candy, President William Howard Taft, Karen Carpenter. What do all these people have in common? These people were highly successful people that had money. Aretha Franklin, they had money and they were at the top of their game. And this disease came into their life and killed them. Killed them. Okay? They had the money that you only dream about. They had the fame that you only dream about. Aretha Franklin, Mama Cass Elliot, Karen Carpenter, these women had voices like angels. Yet, Karen Carpenter was 34 years old when her anorexia took her out. Mama Cass Elliot was a young woman. Aretha lived longer, but Mama Cass Elliot, she was a young woman, dead as a doornail. Dead as a doornail. James Gandolfini, the one that played Tony Soprano. Young man, 52 years old, 53, died in Italy in front of his 10-year-old son from this disease. Every year of The Sopranos, he was bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Look at this. If you look at The Sopranos, every year, there's six seasons, every year, he was markedly larger than he was the year before. So, no human power could have relieved our compulsive overeating, and God could and would if he were sought. If you're sitting there struggling with this idea that God can and will help you, maybe you need to look at your conception of God. I hear this every week of my life. How could there be a God when there was a Holocaust? How could there be a God when there was chattel slavery? How could there be a God with the trail of tears? How could there be a God when people do these things to each other? God is crying too. God doesn't make robots, He makes people. And as people, we have free will to do good or bad. You have choices that you can make. And oftentimes, human beings make choices that hurt or kill other people. But God, we are not Calvinists. Calvinism is where everything is predetermined. Like if I go like this with my hand, that was determined, 20,000 years ago. I'm not a Calvinist. I don't believe in Calvinism. If you are, that's okay. That's fine. I'm not knocking it. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying I am not a Calvinist. I'm not knocking it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I am not one of these people of predetermination. But walk me through how being mad at God, walk me through how not believing in God brings anybody back from the Holocaust. Walk me through how me eating pizza in 2024 mitigates the horrific nightmare of chattel slavery that went on in this country. Walk me through how me eating potato chips is going to mitigate, is going to change that. Walk me through how me eating a chocolate soda a sundae is going to mitigate the trail of tears. If you can make a case that my eating a chocolate sundae is going to change that, well, hell, I'll go with you to the nearest ice cream store and eat 20 of them. I will go with you to the nearest place and eat 20 of them. But at some point, I have to say to myself, am I going to let Hitler kill one more Jew by me dying in the food? If I die in the food, if I die when I'm 400 pounds, how does that help anybody? Except maybe my undertaker. It's about it. Maybe my undertaker will benefit. And I guess the United States government won't have to pay my Social Security anymore, so they would benefit at some point. They would have sort of a cash. They won't have to pay my Social Security anymore. But that's about it. But if you have a case where the Trail of Tears would not have happened if I ate Kentucky Fried Chicken, please call me this afternoon. And walk me through how that happens. Walk me through the ugliness, the nightmare of slavery of in this and other countries had it too, but other countries I can't speak for that. I can only speak for the horrible, horrible nightmare that went on in this country for hundreds of years. The horrible nightmare of what went on right in this country. But if you have a way of me eating Doritos and French fries, how that's going to change that, please call me this afternoon. I sure would like to know. I sure would like to know. Now, this is important stuff because our society, our culture is a culture that says you can do it. We grow up in a Western culture. And in Western culture, we are taught to admire self-sufficiency, right? Here's a self-made man. She's a self-made woman. Right away, we've got our respect eyes on. You know, in Mr. Potato Head, they have his angry eyes and they have his sad eyes, and then and he's got his whatever. We have our respect eyes going on because there's a self-made woman, there's a self-made man. They rose up above poverty and now they're millionaires and blah, blah, blah. Bill Gates, perfect. Warren Buffett, perfect. What's the guy from Tesla? I can't think of his name, but whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, these guys came, they saw, they conquered. They came, they saw, they conquered. They saw a need and they filled that need, Bezos with Amazon, and they conquered. Boy, did they. And we respect them. And you want to be somebody who recovers by yourself on your own. I hear this every day. I don't want to make outreach calls. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. Well, this is a program of getting out of yourself. You're not going to recover by yourself. It's not going to happen. A solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. So let's take a look at this next paragraph at the very bottom of XXIX. And what is the first sentence? It says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. Now, this flies in the face of everything I have ever been told. Flies in the face of it. My mother and father, and my doctor and my teachers, and the adults in my life, and the people in my life said to me, you can do this. You just need willpower. You need discipline. You need to push yourself away from the table. I was hospitalized when I was in high school. I had dysentery that I got from eating spoiled food. And the psychiatrist came to my room in the hospital, and she said to me, keep a picture of something that you really like to remind you not to eat so much. This is a psychiatrist. You could put a picture of anything you flippin' want on my refrigerator. I know what's inside the refrigerator. That picture ain't gonna mean crap to me after the second or the third time I see it, because my mind is fixated on that sense of ease and comfort that's going to come instantly by eating that food. You are not going to dissuade me from eating food that I want to eat with a picture. You're not going to dissuade me of eating food that I want to eat with an armed guard, let alone a picture. Put a machine gun in that armed guard's hand and put him in front of my refrigerator. I'll kill the bastard with my bare hands to get at whatever's in there. So a picture is not going to help me. And the nutritionist, the dietitian, as it was called in those days, she came up to my room and she told me that whatever you want to eat, eat half of it. Now that's brilliant advice. You're talking about a physical allergy that I am afflicted with. And once I eat fried chicken, once I eat ice cream, Doritos, pizza, candy, whatever that might be, I'll eat half, yeah, half of what's in the world. And then tomorrow I'll eat the other half. There is no eating half for people like me. That's crap. That's stupid advice. It's stupid. And one day, somebody came along and said, you need a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And the only way you're going to have that is if you work the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were the only ones that ever helped me. They were the only ones that ever pointed me in the right direction. Push yourself away from the table. Exercise, drink water before you eat. It'll kill your appetite. Do this, stand on your head and make noises like a chicken. How ridiculous this advice was for a person like me is indescribable. It's indescribable how ridiculous that advice was for me and people like me. Eat half, push yourself away from the table, use willpower. You might as well give me a genie in a bottle and tell me to rub the lamp. And when the genie comes out, she'll cast a spell on me that I won't want to eat. You might as well say that, because that's just as far off reality as any of these other things. I am not normal when it comes to food. I'm just not. And that advice, and I knew when I was 15, when I was hospitalized, I knew not to say this, but I said to myself at that time, that may work for people like you. You're normal, you look normal, you look like you've never overeaten in your life. That may work for people like you. Doesn't work for people like me. There's something different about me and you. And I was right. I was 100% right. I just didn't know that it was a disease, but I knew it was a disease, but I didn't know it. I thought there was something like that going on with me, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. Bill Wilson was not a New York City stockbroker. He self-describes as a stockbroker, but he was never a stockbroker. He worked in brokerage offices at times, but he was not a stockbroker. He didn't have a license. And he was a New York City stock speculator. And he made his living giving his opinion to people who purchased stocks. And they would cut him in on the profits. That's how he made his living. He was a New York City stock speculator. And as such, he in 1932 was approached by a group of men from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And in 1932, stocks were at a very low point. And Bill was on one of his diets. And on his diet, he was not drinking. Just like we go on diets, he went on a diet. He went on the wagon. And they approached him, but they said, "We don't want to do business with you if you're going to get drunk." And he'd say, No, I don't get drunk anymore. I've changed. I don't drink." And in 1932, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, they met in a hotel room. And one guy had a bottle of a jug of Jersey Lightning. This was in the days of Prohibition. And he made this bottle of Jersey Lightning. And he says, "Hey, this is kosher. This is vegan. This is vegetarian. This is organic. This is gluten-free. This is whatever it is you want to hear." That's what it was. No gluten, no, it's kosher, it's vegetarian, it's whatever it is. So the bottle, the jug goes around, and Bill Wilson doesn't take a drink. And the guy says to him, "Hey, Wilson, I made this myself. It's kosher, it's vegetarian, it's organic, it's whatever, vegan, it's the best." So Bill Wilson doesn't have any understanding of this disease, nor does anybody else in that room. He takes a sip of whiskey, thinking he's just going to take a sip. And for 3 days, he lay on the bed in that room, unable to move. Because once he took a sip of that whiskey, it triggered his physical allergy, and he was unable to move. For days, and the chance vanished. The chance vanished. Let's continue. We're on X, X, X. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. That was me. I had just given up and I said, "I'll just die." I knew I couldn't live with the food. I knew I couldn't live without the food. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. So I saw no hope for me. I saw no hope for who I was. Every dream I had ever dared to dream was vandalized by this disease. I had crushes on girls, just like any normal boy does. I didn't go on my first date with a girl till I was 35 years old. I never held a girl's hand. I never went to prom. I never went to homecoming. I never went to the dance. I never did any of that. I was a fat boy. Girls don't dance with fat boys. Trust me, they don't. Girls don't date fat boys. Trust me, they don't. So I missed out on all that, and I just wanted to die. I just, yeah, and not just that, but I mean careers and, you know, all that stuff. I just saw no point to life. I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. XXX. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. The decision is step three. Decision is step three, as we know it. They make resolutions. In other words, they go on a diet, but they never work the program. There are people in these rooms right now that are listening to my voice. They're dieting with group support. They're not really working a program. They're dieting with group support. They're just dieting with group support. There's the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. I cannot eat Reese's peanut butter cups. I just can't do it. Every single time I eat Reese's peanut butter cups, I end up buying them 10, 15, 20, 30 packages of them at a time. Every single time I do that, I end up buying them by the, you know, 20 of them, you know, and there's two cups per thing. I'm eating 40, 60, 80 of those Reese's peanut butter cups in a sitting. I can't just have one. I can't do that. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, about whom a whole chapter could be written. I believed that after I lost a certain amount of weight, I could go back to eating the way I ate before and it would be okay. Because all my life, everybody told me, if you lose weight, everything will be okay. I lost a lot of weight and nothing was okay. Nothing was okay. So losing weight didn't fix me and it didn't fix anybody or anything. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He decided, he made up his mind, he decided he wasn't going to touch another drop until he was successful in business. At age 55, he was retired. Out came his carpet slippers in a bottle. Within 4 years, he was dead. He was an alcoholic, which means his disease was permanent, progressive, and fatal. If unchecked, it's fatal. Is my 25 years of abstinence going to buy me a minute or anything? No. I have to keep working the steps. Is me losing 500 pounds going to buy me a minute? No. I have to keep working the steps. Losing weight and length of abstinence will not fend off this disease. I'm going to say that again. Losing weight and years of abstinence will not fend off this disease. This disease is permanent, progressive, and fatal. My friend in Oklahoma says permanent, progressive, and fatal. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect. I hope this is me. Except in the effect alcohol has upon them, they are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, he calls it a phenomenon because he knows it's there, he just can't explain it. As we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This is the third time that Dr. Silkworth is going to tell us to put down the food. Put the food down. So in the questions and answers, somebody's going to say, how do I put the food down? You see this pen? I'm going to put the pen down. That's how you put it down. And you don't pick it up. You make phone calls. You do what you need to do. Do you eat your regular meals? Yes. You need a food plan. I'm not telling you to starve yourself. I'm not telling you to starve yourself. I am telling you, you have to put down the food. And without putting down the food, there is no hope of my recovery. None. Zero. I cannot work the steps while I'm eating. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. That doesn't mean that every once in a while I eat Captain Crunch. That doesn't mean that every once in a while I eat Doritos. That doesn't mean that every once in a while I eat French fries or I eat whatever it is, you know, whatever, you know, pizza or whatever the hell it is. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means we have entire abstinence. Abstain means to refrain from. To refrain from. We refrain from compulsive overeating. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is chronic? It means some condition that is there all the time. I have what's called chronic AFib. My heart is always in AFib. I never come out of it. I haven't been out of AFib in 15, 16 years, something like that. I go to the cardiologist twice a year and I live with it. I haven't been out of AFib since probably 2007, 2008. That's the last time I was out of AFib. What is the solution, top of XXXI, XXXI? What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. Now, the very first experience is Hank Parkhurst. And the next one is Fitz Mayo. We're not going to get to Fitz today. We're only going to get to Hank. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, that's the fourth time he's referred to it in this eight-page chapter, four times. Following the elimination of alcohol. Notice it doesn't say following the reduction of alcohol. Notice it doesn't say following the moderation of alcohol. Notice it doesn't say following the tapering off of alcohol. It says following the elimination of alcohol. Elimination, done. There was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. Let's do the other one. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. This is Fitz Mayo. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, in other words, the elimination of alcohol, brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth. Now, the extent, the depth at which I accept the doctor's opinion will mark the urgency with which I will work the rest of the steps. If I accept this, that means I am sick. I am not bad. I am not weak. I am not horrible. I have a disease that only a spiritual awakening will conquer. There is nothing about my life that is going to change this. I could be black, white, green, yellow, gay, straight, rich, poor. I could be what, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Buddhist. It doesn't matter. It does not matter. Nothing that is of this earth is going to make one bit of difference. My defense must come from a higher power. And what does that mean? That means I am going to have to work these steps. I'm going to have to work them every day of my life, and I am going to have to work them quickly, and I'm going to have to pass this to other people. I have a physical allergy that will manifest every single time. For a long time, I had German shepherds. Every single time somebody came to the door, they would bark. Not most of the time, not some of the time, every time. If there was life in them, when people came to the door, they would bark. That's my physical allergy. Every single time I eat certain things, my allergy is going to manifest in the form of a craving for more of the same. I have a mental twist. And the mental twist is going to be uncomfortable with life as I'm living it. Not because I'm living it incorrectly, not because I'm living it badly, not because I'm living it in any way, shape, or form that is different than the way I should live it, but because that's my mind. And my mind seeks out this effect. And it wants this effect for the purpose of getting rid of the feelings of restless, irritable, discontent, guilt, shame, happiness, fear. My brain needs that food to give it that altered reality. And when I get that altered reality, I'm going to feel fantastic. Can't eat because of the allergy. Can't not eat because of the twist of the mind. I cannot beat this disease on my own by myself. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. So this is something that is not going to yield to earthly conditions. Next week, we're going to start Bill's story, and we're going to approach it from directions you've not approached it before. We're going to give you a lot of history. We're going to give you a lot of information. I hope you'll come back next week. I am thinking again of starting this earlier because I think we get more people. I'm just thinking about it because it's in the middle of the day for many people and they just can't come. So when we started this, I was mimicking what we had been doing live. It never occurred to me that 4 years in, we would still be on Zoom. I never heard of Zoom when we started this, I don't think, but we were, what do you call it? COVID then, it was Corona. If you remember, it was coronavirus. And I'm thinking of rolling it back several hours so that we can get more people. I'm not going to do anything this week. I'm not going to do anything this month. I'm just thinking about it. I'm just thinking about it. So with that, I will turn it back to Nancy or Maria or someone, and we will do our questions and answers until 30 past the hour.
Thanks so much, Harlan. We're going to go over to Veronica. See, thanks for everything today, Harlan. That was
Veronica.
Amazing. We're going to go to Veronica, who's going to do our Q&A. So over to you, Veronica.
Yeah, thank you, Maria. Thank you, Harlan. So my name is Veronica C., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from New York, and I will be your host for the Q&A. Just a reminder that we will post the link to our seventh tradition in the chat, and this money goes towards the cost of our Zoom account and other OA-related expenses. We ask that any announcements made about meeting information be placed in the chat. And if you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand electronically, and we will go down the list of raised hands. Please unmute your microphone when you ask your question to Harlan. We ask that you keep your question as short and concise as possible. Also note that Harlan will not ask any question, answer any questions about food plans or math.
Right.
If you asked a question last week, we ask that you kindly hold back to give others an opportunity. So, anybody have a question for Harlan? You could raise your hand electronically and, okay. Go ahead and unmute. Diane.
Yeah. Diane G., a grateful recovered compulsive overeater from Canada. And Harlan, thank you so much. This is my first time attending this meeting. And I've heard you the last 3 years, and it's really nice to meet you in person.
Thank you.
What I heard is you talked about a spiritual awakening today, but I also hear people talking about a spiritual experience. So is there a difference between a spiritual awakening and a spiritual experience?
Yes.
And if so,
yes,
you can explain that.
A spiritual experience is sudden and profound, and a spiritual awakening takes longer. It's slowly over time. And on page 567 of the big book, there is an appendix, and it's called Appendix 2, and the title of it is Spiritual Experience, and it explains the difference. But basically, a spiritual experience is very fast, and a spiritual awakening is slower. That's the difference. Okay.
Thank you, Diane. Next, we have Beverly. Beverly, please unmute.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Harlan, for explaining the allergy so well. But there was something that you talked about that I didn't understand. You were saying something about AFib.
Yeah, I have something called AFib of the heart. I'm chronic AFib. That's what I was talking about. But AFib is not part of this disease. AFib has nothing to do with the disease of compulsive overeating. It's an atrial fibrillation of the heart. And I'm listed as chronic because it's something that happens all the time. That's what I was talking about.
The reason I asked that is that I went into the hospital since I've been on the program, and I've been off of my diabetic medication, and I'm getting ready to go back in again. And when I went in the hospital, they put me on dextrose, a glucose and water, and they didn't understand. I told them I had an allergy to sugar, but it ran my blood sugar up, and they came in and told me that they were concerned because my heart rate was racing so fast. And I told the doctor to get me off the sugar and my blood pressure. Mm-hmm.
You really have to talk to your physician on this one, Beverly. I don't have answers for any of that.
Thank you very much.
No problem, Beverly. Thanks. Okay, who else?
Thank you, Beverly. Okay, so next we don't have anybody else, but I have a question for you, Harlan.
Okay.
You mentioned about a picture not dissuading you from wanting to eat. But what about people who say that, well, I pray to God to remove my compulsion every single day, and that hasn't happened?
You got to take action. You got to help others. You got to work the steps. Prayer is great. But if you don't take action, faith without works is dead. Faith without works is dead, and work without faith is dead. You got to have the faith and you got to have the action. Praying alone will not help me. I have to translate that prayer into action, specifically the steps, specifically sponsoring other people when I'm on step 12.
Mm-hmm.